Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Punch Drunk Critics Live. It's Sunday night at 7 o'clock, and this is where you got to be every Sunday, because that's what time we're on. What's up, Travis?
I'm good, man. Well, we got to be here every Sunday, then they got to be here every Sunday.
Yeah,
so.
It's no excuse not to be.
Don't care. Although, it'll start getting a little murky once the football season starts next week.
Yeah, so make sure you just keep checking in punchdrunkcritics.com for any audibles, if you don't mind the pun. We might call it the last second. And I also got to put out there right now, we're rating tonight's episode MA, TV MA for mature audiences only. We have a great interview with the cast of some of the cast and the director of For a Good Time Call, movie about a sex phone operation, kind of. So
yes.
It'll get a little dicey if you're under 18. You might want to consult your parents. Parental guidance is suggested.
yeah, absolutely. They were in good spirits that day. It was a star, Ari Grainer, who you know I have a certain fondness for, yes. Ari Grainer. The film's co-writer and co-star, Lauren Miller, who also happens to be Seth Rogen's wife. The other co-writer, Katie Ann Nalen, and the director, Jamie Travis, and they were all in a very talkative, chatty, and occasionally vulgar mood.
Yeah,
during the interview, so I mean, I guess it's kind of unavoidable when you're dealing with the subject of phone sex, and the movie has a lot of raunchy elements to it, so I guess it's unavoidable.
Right, but while I was listening to the interview, I couldn't, and we'll play it for you guys in just a couple minutes here, but I couldn't help but be happy and surprised that they were still so open about it. Doing stuff on screen is one thing, but a lot
correct.
Of people are guarded when it comes to the interview stuff. I don't know why that is, but I do have one question for you before we get into For a Good Call and run the interview. How awkward? I know how awkward I would have been talking about this to two hot women. there's some questions that come up in this interview, like about empowering women in the sex phone operation. Mm-hmm. How nervous were you getting ready to ask these questions that they might be taking the wrong way?
I did not get. I was not worried about that at all. It didn't bother me. I was perfectly comfortable. So I don't know what that says about me, but I had no problems at all talking to them about any of this stuff. I think it might have made it easier, actually, that they were so willing to talk and they were so open about it.
Because
I think if I had gotten the idea that maybe they didn't want to discuss it, I might have backed off a little bit. But no, really.
Everything came out great, and I know that I would have done that one mess up that everybody does where you're thinking in your head, don't say this, say it this way, say it this way, say it this way, and then you say it the worst possible way. I just know that's what I would have done, so
right.
Congrats to you for not doing that.
Well, I think there comes a point at one in the interview where I say something, and I think Ari was a little, I don't know if she was offended or she maybe thought I should have worded it differently, but, that's just kind of how these things are. I'm not perfect, and, people will hear that in the interview anyway.
I actually have the Red Band trailer. I'm going to play that for you guys real quick before we get into the interview. And since you put that out there, I'll go ahead and narrate the part I was going to narrate during the trailer now. The opening part, and it's funny that she got offended because she's in this movie peeing into a cup in the driver, passenger seat.
I don't know if she was offended. I think she just sort of...
not offended, but...
I don't think she's offended.
You'd imagine they couldn't be offended that easily. If, when you hear the water sound, that's what's going on, folks. Here's a Red Band trailer for a Good Time Call.
This is my friend Katie. This is my friend Lauren. She's going to drive you home, okay? Please.
This is yours?
Yeah, sorry. I think it's empty.
Perfect! Yes, this is my new car!
I do this all the time.
Ta-da! See, you don't spill that off.
Get out.
You're in a
cell! I can't afford an apartment by myself in the city.
I have a place for you.
Where?
You.
You.
Hi.
Lady, tell us some more about the new place.
The apartment is spectacular and my roommate is whatever.
Katie, there's no toilet paper.
What? I can't hear you. I'm running late. Bye.
Your dick looks so big. I'm scared. Let me out. Let me out. I want to... I just... Come on, my face. Gotta go. Bye.
No.
I get $1 a minute for a phone sex line. Whatever they say, I just tell them I want to lick it. Like nipple guy, lick it. Hairy balls, lick them all.
Hey, you.
You know, you're not better than me.
You're not better than phone sex.
Better than phone sex. Listen, the job we called you in for was filled this morning.
I want to make a third of the profits, and I'm not getting on the phone. It's strictly business.
Ooh, I like a little fire in you.
1-877,
Cindy, Aaron with the low hanger.
Yes.
Rachel, it's Shmokhayim again.
Billing, please.
Billing!
So you get the gist from that. I'm going to cut the last minute because we have a lot of air to cover tonight. But if you're still on the air and weren't offended, we are glad you shouldn't be because it's funny stuff. I thought the movie was hilarious. But you want to talk about the movie first or you want to run the interview first?
No, let's talk about the movie first.
Cool.
I saw this back at Sundance, so it's been a long time since I actually caught it. But what I remember from it is walking into the theater being extremely excited for it. I was, you know, excited for it because I knew the cast was excited to be making the film, and excited for it because it has such a good cast. I love Ari Grainer. I think Justin Long is great. Seth Rogen and Kevin Smith had appearances in it as well. So I was excited for this movie, and I knew this was going to really be sort of Ari Grainer's coming out party. She's always been sort of the supporting player in most movies. And to be fair, this is her coming out party. I think this is the best role she's ever had. She's fantastic. She commands the screen. I think she is, along with, like, what the hell happened to me? What's wrong with my brain today that I can't remember?
That trailer said. It threw me off, too. Don't worry.
The girl from Greenberg, Greta Gerwig. With Ari Grainer and Greta Gerwig and possibly Aubrey Plaza, I think they're like the three best up-and-coming female comedians in the movies right now. But when I left the theater, I was a little let down. And the biggest problem for me is that I feel like in the wake of Bridesmaids, we've seen a number of these female-centric movies. And we'll talk about Bachelorette in a few weeks when that movie comes out. But I feel like that one goes too far in being a little bit mean-spirited.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas this one, I think, goes too far in being raunchy, and it doesn't provide much else other than that. I didn't get the sort of female camaraderie aspect of it. I thought it touched on it, but didn't give us nearly enough. It really just seemed to settle back on being vulgar and not much else. So I was a little disappointed in the movie.
I'll be honest, and this isn't a sexist thing, I think, but I Bridesmaids, I know everybody loved it. I wasn't that big of a huge of a fan. And I guess it's just because... I don't know why it is.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, I know. It's sexist. But I don't mean it to be. It's just how I feel about the movie.
It's not sexist at all.
I wasn't sure going to this movie how I would like it. But Ari Grainer, I've liked since I first saw her. She was to me, I know you love Nick Norris' Infinite Playlist, but she was the standout of that whole movie as the friend that was eating gum out of the throw-up toilet. But another gross role for her. But, you know, and to be honest, I was never a big fan of Jenny McCarthy's farting on TV type deal. Like, I don't know.
I don't like it either.
You know, hot girls doing that stuff, it just doesn't jive with me.
I don't get the appeal.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, that's why I have buddies, is to, you know, that they can do that crap around me. I don't need to see a hot girl doing that. But I wasn't bothered by this movie at all, and I actually laughed quite a bit. I actually liked it quite a bit. I think you're right. I was really expecting the relationship between the two girls to be more like Saturday Night Live girls, one can't have a baby, surrogate mother. Mm-hmm. What was that movie called?
Baby Mama?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, with she's on 30 Rock. What is her name? Yeah, Baby Mama, that's it. I was expecting
Tina Fey
like
and Amy Poehler.
Yeah, I was expecting more like that with like two polar opposites and finding middle ground in some place, you know, and more of a heartfelt story there. And they did kind of throw that out. This is more Hangover than something that's actually got a story. I don't know what else to put it to, but this is all raunch comedy. Bridesmaids did have the story in it. I will give it that. And it had less. If you switch the story with the raunchiness of Bridesmaids, that's kind of what you have as far as a theme on this movie. I did like it. I thought it was good. I think it's gonna be a rental for most people, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to end up being a rental for most people. And you know, and I do think, I do love the enthusiasm that they had for this movie. I think Lauren Miller has a future, and her and Katie Ann Nayland, who is also another attractive woman, I might add. so I was in a room full of attractive women that day, and one gay dude. So, yeah, that's just kind of how it was. But
I got to give Jamie Travis credit, because I was laughing. You know,
he was awesome. He was great.
I don't want to say anything to offend anything here, but I liked how he owned who he was. He even says something in the interview at one point, which you'll hear, is he's like, my agent kept giving me stuff for these testosterone filled movies, and I was like, really? You know, I love the fact that you know, he owns
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, he was great. All three women were fantastic, and I wish I had loved the movie as much as they loved making it. Now, that's my biggest problem with it. But we haven't even really described what the plot is, and essentially what you have here is a situation where Lauren Miller's character is sort of the straight-laced girl, you know, didn't do a whole lot. Ari Grainer is ostensibly the more exciting, free-spirited girl. They're kind of enemies over the years, but when one is forced to find a roommate for her apartment, they move in together, start a phone sex line, and things take off from there. It becomes a big hit. The best part of the movie to me were some of the cameos. I thought Kevin Smith's cameo as a caller to their phone sex line, I thought it was one of the funniest things I've seen him do in ages.
Oh, no doubt.
He's only on the screen for a couple of minutes, but it's pure Kevin Smith. I wouldn't be surprised if that part was ad-libbed, to be honest.
Oh, no, I wouldn't be surprised. If you've ever seen his Q&As that are on Netflix and DVD, the dude can talk off the cuff. And I don't think there's a better person to put in for that cameo than Kevin Smith. And also because I wasn't expecting these cameos. It was kind of like, whoa, you know, it's a little more impact that way.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, her husband, Seth Rogen, she's probably got a pretty extensive Rolodex at this point.
I can imagine.
But yeah, I mean, Mimi Rogers is in it. Nia Vardalos from My Big Fat Greek Wedding has a role in it. Mark Webber, another good actor. I didn't really buy much into the kind of love story that kind of develops in the middle of the film. Didn't really do much for me. And I wish there was a little bit more Justin Long, to be honest. But he's good in the roles he has as their gay friend. He's gay in the movie, right? Yeah, he is their gay friend. But I didn't feel like they used him as well as he can be used. I think he's better as a supporting actor than he is as a leading man. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel like he was used all that well here. But overall,
yeah, I didn't feel like he fit all that well.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I like Justin Long is a guy I know a lot. There's a good margin of people that don't like to see him on screen, or you know, he's a source of talking bad. But you know, I like him. Like, what was it? The movie when he was in Accepted. You know, I actually liked him in that movie in the leading role, but it's a certain type of leading role he has to be in. But he did well enough. I probably would have been somebody better for it.
Right. No, I agree. But overall, it's been, like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I stick by my score. I gave this a 2.5 out of 5 when I saw it out of Sundance. So I'm sticking by that. What's your score for A Good Time Call?
I'm actually surprised I'm going higher than you on this one. I'm 3 out of 5 on this one. It's probably because I'm not gonna placate it to being due to something else. But I not liking Bridesmaids, my expectations were kind of low. But that doesn't mean it's not a good movie. I did enjoy it. I had a lot of good laughs. And you know, if you don't blush easily, it's a fun movie to watch.
Right. All right. So middle of the road scores for A Good Time Call. But like we said earlier, they were really excited about this movie. Lauren Miller and Katie Ann Nayland, they wrote Ari Grainer's role specifically for her. Like, the character was made for her. It's based on Nayland's own experiences working in the phone sex industry, which was a topic of discussion during the interview as well. So let's go ahead.
Yeah, that's where it got interesting.
That is where it got interesting. So let's jump into the interview now with the cast of For A Good Time Call.
So how have the last few months been, you know, ever since? Because it's got good buzz coming out of the festival. So how's that been going for you guys?
It's been awesome. I mean,
massively exciting and nerve-wracking and dream come truly.
Yeah, people seem to like it. You know, it's like, once people see it, they all seem to really like it. So, you know, so it's just been, you know, the past few months have been about us, like, thinking of ways and obviously the focus to get people to see it.
That's usually a good thing when they come out of the movie liking it.
I think so. I know what you're going for.
Sundance was such amazing reassurance for us because we made the film so quickly and kind of, like, you know, it was such a passion project. And then, you know, I don't know if you were there on the Sunday night, maybe not, but there was a standing ovation.
When they say Sunday night was our premiere.
Okay, I was not there.
Right.
So
it was our,
I saw it later the next week.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that's good then. That's really good. So who, somebody had to have had a sex line. That's.
And it was Jamie.
It was me.
No, it was me. It was me. My freshman year in college, I needed some money, and instead of being an annoying telemarketer, I was an awesome phone sex operator. And I started my own hotline just to capitalize on my newfound skill and cut out the middleman, as I like to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and it was always a really funny story to tell at bars and in parties, and guys loved it, and girls loved it, and they'd pull me aside later and be like, where's the ticks go?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what are the guys saying? And so I knew that was a funny kind of a story to tell. And then Lauren and I wanted to tell a story about female friendship instead of the guy version of the buddy comedy or the rom-com is what women are sort of relegated to. And, yeah, so that's what we did.
So now you know I have to ask, do you still do the voice that she used on the phone?
You know,
every time she calls me?
Yeah. You know, I didn't really have to. I think the voicing is sort of a fallacy because my voice is pretty hot already. I'm pretty sure that I don't need to do any voices. I think the dirty shit that comes out of my mouth is quite enough.
Well, I think, like, you know, you've said in the past, like, that when the guys are calling, like, it's not really the sound of the voice that's you know, it's not that important. They're on a mission, you know?
Right.
Yeah, then the voice
is
the line.
What they want, right?
They're usually at half mast. You know, they're at stage 2 and stage 4 when they call. I used to work on Viagra. Stage 4 is what you're looking for. You want stage 4.
She means in advertising.
In advertising. Now we're kind of like in the lab.
They still work on Viagra.
Oh,
not
like she's on
the paper.
With goggles.
Oh, exactly. You're like a lab coat just surrounded by the red team that
she
was messing
with.
We're at work. What kind of Viagra to me? I would take Viagra and go to work. Working on Viagra. That is not true. Sorry. In advertising, I worked briefly as a copywriter on the Viagra campaign. But yes, the voice isn't totally necessary. I from time to time when I'm trying to feel charming, I might throw a little something on it. But normally it's this one now.
I like
bringing
the voice.
It.
I think it's fun.
Little Miss Grainer.
So now you've gotten into the whole thing.
I mean, I don't actively have phone sex, but I like my phone sex voice. My phone sex voice gives me a little extra
really
of confidence. It's like I'm a superhero. And my really lame superpower is a brief moment of sounding like I have a sexy voice, but that's it. Nothing else happens.
Well, I imagine that, like most sex trades, it's very empowering for women, I guess, in a way. You know, I hate to throw the porn thing out there, but it's true women run that industry, you know, and it's empowering in a sense, you know, even, you know, there's a stripper pole in the movie, but strippers, it seems demeaning to people on the outside, but it's really sort of an empowering thing for a lot of women as well, you know?
Well, I think in this movie it's less about we're saying that phone sex is empowering, and I think it's more that it's empowering that they start a business together, that they're able to open up to each other and discover who they are and the freedom in that. I mean, I feel... I think it was pretty clear we weren't trying to make a statement about you know, and I would maybe disagree about people running, females running the porn industry, although maybe, but
I mean, I do think that there's something really powerful about women taking charge of their own sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is
maybe that's
that,
more what I mean.
That you know, that's something that Katie and Lauren in the movie do in their own way, and I think that for each of them as individuals, like, you know, Lauren really finding her voice, and that comes from the phone sex line, but also from her best friend, and at the same time, Katie's character also finds her own sexuality, again, somewhat through the phone sex line, but again, with her interactions through her best friend, I think what we really wanted to portray was how, you know, friendships and how the women in your lives can affect and change who you are. Well, it's very layered, actually, because if you think about it, like, the... You know, Katie's hiding behind a phone line, and it is very confidence building for her in a way that she can be very brash in real life when she hasn't really, you know, she's not really that kind of person underneath it all. So there's that. And also, I think we've sort of taken charge as filmmakers, mm-hmm. and we're women, except for Jamie Travis, our lovely director.
Honorary.
Mm-hmm. An honorary girl on this trip. And he loves
it. I apparently wear lady sandals, so.
People have been making fun of his lady sandals on the internet now.
On Facebook.
Because
and these weren't even new sandals that looked like lady sandals.
No, these are the lady sandals.
It was the one open. The other
one was I know, I got a few pairs.
So you got to cause a fool,
baby. But I don't want to give your ears the wrong impression.
The ones with the kitten heels were pretty much.
Yeah.
No, but Jamie's actually. No, but definitely, I mean, if you want to talk female empowerment, I think the way we kind of grabbed this idea of making a movie about female friendship and having an R-rated comedy, it's like a really novel idea, and everyone's like, yeah, good luck with that, cause we're not bankrolling it. And then Lauren and I decided to go out on our own, and we would not take no for an answer, and then we found like-minded people to get on our bandwagon, and we haven't let them get off.
And we shot this in 16 days, and, you know, for very little money, and all of us were sort of new at creating a movie from start to finish, sort of essentially on our own. You know, we didn't have a big fancy lead producer who was sort of teaching us everything, has been sort of really grassroots and from the ground up, and you know, much like Angel Way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask about that specifically because the movie is very raunchy, very frank, and you don't see that very often with, you know, female comedies. So I was going to ask you about the kind of roadblocks you would have faced trying to get that movie off the ground, you know?
We did face roadblocks. Katie, we wrote the script 3 years ago, and it went out wide as a spec, and it was extremely well-received. People loved it. We had, like, 60 meetings with people who would quote it and be like, I love this, I love that, I love this, but I can't make it because R-rated female comedies don't do well. And it was so frustrating, and we, you know, we tried to keep pushing and making it through a studio system or whatever, but this was a pre-Bridesmaids time, and, you know, and you know, studios were nervous about it. So, you know, it was something that we had to push forward and, you know, keep going and not take no for an answer and find our own way to tell the story.
Do you think that with, I guess, in this post-Bridesmaids, hey, comparing everything to Bridesmaids, it's a great movie, there's no doubt that it's opened some doors. Do you think that we'll be seeing a lot more of these down the line?
So.
Do you guys hope to make more movies similar to this?
Well, yeah. I think we always talk about and bond over our 80s movies and how in the 80s there were so many female-driven comedies and there were so many great roles for women that weren't just about getting the guy. And that's something that, you know, we definitely tried to do and hope that this, you know, is like that and that there will continue to be more movies like that because, you know, who wouldn't want to see a movie that, you know, that's about something we can really relate to?
And also hopefully it'll stop being, you know, like many things in this world that shouldn't be issues that still have to be conversations, you know, that that hopefully it will be something where we can all take for granted that there are movies for women, by women, in all kinds of different genres where it doesn't have to be such a big deal.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the,
that's
the hope.
Yeah, you don't want to just be, oh, this is the female comedy. You want
Yeah, those are the comedy.
Yeah,
they'll often say, like, the female Judd Apatow or the female this, or they do the same thing with Lena Dunham and Girls, and it's like, we're not the female version of anything. We're just being ourselves. And we happen to be super funny because women are funny.
And the truth is, I say guys really like this movie.
They really like it.
There were a bunch of guys there last night with their girlfriends, and we're totally happy to have seen this movie. And I think that, you know, I mean, you're a guy, you liked it. And,
I'm a guy, and I liked it.
Yeah. So I think that is not just for
last I checked, I wasn't. But yeah, I imagine it's probably because a lot of guys see a little something of themselves in the guys who call in, probably more than
something else. Interesting. Which caller? I was going to say, maybe they see themselves inside one of those girls.
Oh!
Hey! I don't know which guy I would be, to be honest. But would you say that your characters reflect a part of you in a lot of ways, or no?
Well, for sure, me. I mean, you know, when we wrote the script, I was never going to play Lauren, but these characters are... I mean, I feel like they're exaggerations of ourselves, you know, and so certainly, you know, there's a little bit of core Lauren in there, and, you know, I hope I'm just not that boring.
So far,
little bit more exciting than fictional Lauren.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, and for me, you know, I there was so much that I related to with Katie, and a huge part of that is I love looking at characters of how they present themselves to the world versus how they actually see themselves, how they actually feel inside. And, you know, Katie is somebody, especially at the beginning of the film, that comes across with so much bravado, and she's so well defended and seems like she's got it all figured out. She doesn't need anybody, and she can take on the world and totally independent, and really she's actually deeply, deeply vulnerable and insecure and really wanting and needing love and to be appreciated and to be accepted. And I absolutely feel all those things. And I think a lot of times with me, people will often comment on my confidence, and which me and my closest friends find hilarious because I'm often on the phone, you know, crying in a totally insecure state half the time. So I think that balance was really, I loved that about the character when I read it.
But you seem to have a trend of playing characters who are really confident and strong, though. They're usually supporting characters. And
yeah.
It's really your first time to be, like, the lead or a lead. So how's that been for you?
It's so exciting, you know. I mean, I've been so lucky with the people that I've worked with over the years and in the movies I've been able to be a part of. Like, it's a really thrilling thing to look back at all those movies, and there's not one that I think, like, oh God, that was shit, I wish I didn't do that. You know, I really, really loved all of them and have learned so much. And, you know, I was really ready and excited to take on more of a lead role just by the very challenge of taking a character from point A to point B in a full journey from start to finish. Or sometimes, if you got really lucky with the supporting characters like Carolyn and Nick and Nora, you can still do that. But sometimes those roles end up feeling like a little bit divisive for the plot or for the lead character, and so there's not that much that you can explore as an actor. And I love that my characters have had sort of a strength and a sense of fun. And I think it's always, like, in every person, there's this duality of strength and vulnerability, and that's what I respond to most in actors that I see, and so I hope that I can try to sort of do that in each role, but make them all different.
Okay. Did you all four know each other beforehand, before this movie? Because you have this really kind of easy chemistry together, and it kind of reflects on screen as well, so did you guys know each other before?
We didn't. I mean, well, Lauren and I obviously did.
We
met from 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Well, we were 12 at the time. Yeah. She borrowed my bicycle, the stage, the streamers. No, you know, we met years and years ago, and then when we wrote the script, I mean, we had this one's voice in our head a little bit, and so when we decided to make the film independently, she was our first stop when we kind of wrote her a love letter and asked her to be in the movie and to come on board and work with us, and so. And she wrote us a letter that was equally amazing and emotional. And then when I went to look for directors, someone had sent us a link to Jamie's work in the New York Times. They had done a profile of him. And I was just, I was blown away. And then Lauren was like, oh, I didn't have time to open it. I didn't have time to open it. Because that's how Lauren is. And then...
She finally opened it.
And you saw
opened what?
The link. Right, exactly. I was like, oh, I'll take it. And then Ari actually saw, like, literally, like, 30 seconds of one of his films and was like, oh, my God, it's him. Mm-hmm. And then when we met Jamie, we were just thick as thieves. It was a house on fire kind of situation.
And then all four of us spent about a month at Lauren's dining room table in pre-production. I mean, we had been communicating and working before, but then Jamie was living with Lauren. I would come over every day, and the four of us would just sit there and really worked through the script and got the production going and got it as tight as possible, and you know, that was over a year ago, and so we've been deeply in each other's lives for the past year.
And back to the women's film thing, I had been reading scripts for years that were, like, very testosterone driven, and I was always like, why is my agent sending me these testosterone scripts? And so this was the first script that I read that was, like, that really celebrated female sexuality and you know.
So you turned down Spider-Man.
Well, I was going to ask you, how's the transition been for you? Because you come from short film background, mostly.
Good. I mean, this whole process has been such a blur because it's been so quick, and it's been so, you know, I've been saying this a lot, but, like, it's a lot of the decision-making comes from the gut as opposed to the brain when you're working this quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a really smooth transition for me. I've had the good fortune of working with such amazing actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, my short films are so much more kind of formal and they're very director-driven. And so it was great for me to kind of stand back and let it be about the story and the characters and the performances. And so it's been really inspiring for me in terms of moving forward and figuring out how I can combine those two things in future films.
There's been a lot of people lately, I don't know if it's a current trend, but a lot of people are like taking their short stories and expanding them into features. Would you consider doing something like that?
One of my short films?
Yeah.
No, I think the short films that I've made are very specifically, they fit into the shape that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine ever.
Satisfying the world for 2 hours.
Oh my God. That would be the saddest role in the world.
Yeah. They're also just so specifically visual that it's something that works much better in short form,
mm-hmm.
you know?
They're also killing it on the internet right now. Can I just say that Jamie put a Vimeo page up with his, before his work was under like lock and key, you had to like get it on YouTube and it had like German subtitles. I know, because I used to send it to my friends, or I have all these DVDs in my bag I hand out when I meet people, but now they're on Vimeo and he went from like, what was it, Jamie, from like 1,000 hits to like 20,000.
Wow.
Just
what?
In the last 2 days.
No,
I think he had 19,000
new
hits on his
that's
video.
That's amazing. Well, it was favorited on Vimeo. It was a staff pick on Vimeo.
Wow.
And then this site, Short of the Week, reviewed The Armoire, and like the combination of this has led to 20,000 views.
No way.
Yeah.
And he's so shy about it, but I'm just going to tell you right now, and I think it's great for our film too, that like that Jamie's voice is out there, because when we saw Jamie's work, it was like, how do we not work with this guy? Like,
it felt like finding the newest major auteur. Like, it's not, it was so fascinating. We met with so many really talented people that were good at what they did, but the difference between somebody that's good at what they do and somebody who is a visionary, when you're able to see them next to each other, it's a black and white issue, and it's Jamie and...
You're a visionary, dude.
He's a
visionary. I like that word. I feel like luminary.
With airy. Ingenue is fine.
That one's a little bit beyond me.
The spelling's tricky, but you'll get to it.
Okay. Wow, that went fast. You guys are a great, great interview.
Thanks.
It's like I interview people like you all the time.
Mm.
But you guys got a lot of great cameos and supporting players in this movie. So how did all of those pieces come together as well? Because I get why you four are together. You guys, thick as thieves here. It's cool. But how did everybody else come about?
Well, we had these calls that were in the script, and it was clear that like they could be really great cameos if we could get like really amazing comedians to come out and play with us, and that would be such a fun way to do that. And
mm-hmm.
so I knew Kevin Smith and just sent him an email, and he was so cool and just to come on board and like we're not even sure if he like read the whole thing.
No, he didn't.
He told me on set that he had only read his scenes. And he's such an amazing supporter of independent film or whatever, and was just so excited. So and I slept with Seth Rogen, and so he did it. And
and I slept with Ken Marino.
Right.
So.
And I slept with Martha McIsaac.
I find it very hard to believe. No, but it was Justin Long.
This is the third.
They didn't
film.
Sleep together.
We
but
didn't. No, we only thought about it. No, Justin and I. This is our third film. Justin and I have done together.
Mm-hmm.
We did Youth of Revolt and a movie called 10 Years, which is opening in September as well.
It's the Channing Tatum produced movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Justin was actually the first person we sent the script to, and for Sean, and he loved it. But said he wanted to play Jesse, and we hadn't thought about him for that role, but he's such a comedic genius. We were so thrilled to have him.
I didn't know how good he was until I had worked with him, until he was in our movie. Like, because I've always been a fan of him. He's such a solid actor, but I feel like he's a hidden secret. I feel like people don't know how truly talented he is.
I think he's really, really good in supporting roles where he gets to play the friend. And he always brings something different to the table each time, which I always think
smart,
is...
Yeah.
He has such a creative mind, and I think, you know, this is sort of true for the characters in this movie, but I think, you know, you were talking about supporting roles, blah, 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 but I think in general, a lot of times with movies, especially
in comedies or any kind of romantic comedies, it's the supporting characters are sort of the more well-rounded, interesting, fun, unique personas, and sometimes the leads can be a little dry. And that's what was so exciting with this, is to have, like, these two lead characters that were completely unique, had their own voice, and in a way that I feel like you don't often see. And I mean, I think we did that with the, I think you did that with the supporting roles as well. Like, Jesse is unexpected, Quincy is unexpected, mm-hmm. but anyway, I don't know.
And Justin did the character study of Jamie
mm-hmm.
Travis
yeah.
here, so
he also wears lady
so
sandals.
He's not a cliche gay guy. He's our favorite gay guy.
Did you make all the guys wear lady sandals during mm-hmm. during the show?
I didn't know they were lady sandals until Boston
told someone told you.
Lady sandals. no, I did not enforce footwear. In fact, this is, would be very irresponsible footwear on set. I always have closed toes.
It's really funny. Justin would like follow Jamie around and like walk like him and stood like him. And our costume designer loved to play up his wardrobe to copy Jamie's wardrobe. And
mm-hmm.
we just loved laughing at that.
Yeah. Yeah. That provided us with endless entertainment, especially when Jamie would like kind of glance over his shoulder
yeah.
like vaguely and like annoyed and thinking that he was being mocked. Which he wasn't, but he was being honored.
No, I took it as the ultimate compliment. I mean, there were so many times where I was like, okay, a little less gay. I just wanted to be a little less gay. I feel like those are the only words I ever said to him.
That's true.
I'm always curious, whenever there's a movie like this where there's a lot of sex and dildos and things like that, what do your families like react to? Do they come on set for movies like this?
Well, our parents are supportive and it's uncomfortable a little bit. It's funny, my dad is super into movies and we sent him the script early on and his notes were like all about coming up with more creative names for the penises. And was just like, we have more variety. What about Wang? What about Schwanz? And like
I
and
love Schwanz.
You know, and it's just so it's just funny, and we've all like had to watch it with our parents. Well, Jamie hasn't quite yet done that,
but I think it's more awkward for us than it is for them. Like my parents love it; they love the movie. They're so excited. My dad just saw it the other night. My mom has kind of been around, but I felt more blushy and nervous thinking about my dad watching some of those things than he did. And he just said, like, when I watch you, you're a character. I don't think about it like I'm watching you. I completely fall into whatever you're doing. And
he thinks about me.
He thinks about
Katie. He's like, if you know the real Katie, it's a real issue. And he needs to figure that out.
Maybe they'll make a movie about you next.
Or
well, this okay. is about her.
So this character is, so some of the characters is,
oh yeah, I mean yeah. She has my silhouette.
It's Katie, it's Lauren.
Okay.
I mean it's us, and then it's just an exaggerated version of us.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So, is there any hope of maybe seeing? Because I think there's a very natural continuation of these characters. So, would you like to possibly revisit them down the line?
It'll be really funny. Like, we'll do it in 30 years. They're both in their 60s, and and they're still running the line. They're still living together, and she's like, "Remember that asshole, Sean? What a jerk!
Oh, Sean, whatever happened to Sean?"
And like,
we'll
suddenly we have really strong New York accents, and our orgasms
they
sound like
Florida.
Yeah.
It's
my 5 o'clock regular.
Hello,
early bird.
We're doing early bird.
His name's Metamucil.
Guys, it could be called Golden Showers Girls.
Oh my God!
No.
I take on Golden Girls.
Okay.
Why don't you take his hand and walk him through it?
Well, 30 years down the line, I mean, they might not even have phones.
They could be like Reality Park, 1962.
It's like holographic phone sex.
Well, the thing about phone sex is that people like to be anonymous. No one wants
anonymous.
Not
everyone
wants.
That's true. I agree that is a big part of the anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like finished, so.
Well,
this was awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is great.
Thanks,
Brad. Yeah, it's not a problem, man. This is a lot of fun. The time flew by.
Thanks so much.
All right, and that was the interview with Katie Ann Nalen and Lauren Miller and Ari Grainer and Jamie Travis from For a Good Time Call. As you can probably tell, we had a lot of fun during that interview.
Yeah, it definitely sounded like a good time. Boy, listen again.
It was.
You really want to be in that room to see what they were doing during some of the things they were saying.
They were just chilling. They were sitting on the couch, chilling. Ari Grainer.
Yeah, but we got to elaborate and make stuff up. Oh, wait, that's not responsible journalism?
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
Oh, well.
No, but it was great. All right, so that was For a Good Time Call. We still have another movie to talk about. We're about 40 minutes into the show now. But
yeah.
We've got to talk about Lawless, which is the new film with Tom Hardy, Shia LaBeouf, Gary Oldman, Mia Wasikowska, Jessica Chastain. Incredible cast.
It's only a minute long. I know we're running late, but I remembered to get the clip, so here's Lawless.
I know who you are.
Yeah, who's that?
One of them Bond Grant boys. My daddy says you boys are the worst thing ever to hit Franklin.
Tell your daddy I said hi.
Seems you've been involved in certain illegal activities.
There's a new special deputy.
I'm the one who's going to make your life real difficult from now on if you don't toe the line, country boy.
I'm a bonder.
We don't lay down for nobody.
We are survivors. We control the fear. Without the fear, we are all as good as dead. This is a war they're waging. Who ain't gonna survive? It is not the violence that sets man apart. It is the distance that he is prepared to go. Lawless. August 29th.
I love that line. It's
which
just,
one?
It's not the violence that makes me. Well, I'll let you get started. We if anybody didn't check it already, we have make sure to go back in our archived shows. We have an interview with the writer of the original source novel, The Wettest County, Matt Bondurant, who, if you heard the name in the trailer, is actually related to the three guys in the movie. That's always cool to talk to somebody like that.
It is. It is. He did extensive research, going back to his family tree. He's from Alexandria, Virginia. Went back in time and looked back at his family. His grandfather and his two great uncles are the Bondurant boys, who in the film are depicted by Tom Hardy and Shia LaBeouf and Jason Clark. All three give very strong performances. I even like Shia LaBeouf here, and I'm not a big fan of his, but I thought that he fits the role of Jack Bondurant very well. And when I was reading the book,
they're both kind of
D-bags. When I was reading the book, I was able to picture him in the role. I thought he really got it down well. And Jack's sort of the dreamer of the three brothers. They all run this illegal moonshine operation in Virginia, and the winds of change are coming in 1930s Franklin County, basically, in the form of Charlie Rakes, who's a Chicago special prosecutor who's coming out there, and he's going to turn things around and get rid of all the bootlegging that's going on. And then there's also Gary Oldman, who's kind of coming in as a Chicago gangster. Floyd Banner. So things are changing in Franklin County, and Forrest Bondurant's not really one who deals with change very well, and he kind of fights it as violently, tooth and nail, as he possibly can. So that's really the crux of the film, is them trying to hold on to their operation. And the movie gets extremely violent, and extremely grisly, extremely bloody, which you kind of would expect from a movie by John Hillcoat and Nick Cave,
who gave us
The Road and the Proposition, two very violent movies that are similar in tone to this one.
Oh, definitely. But before we get into talk about the movie real quick, I thought of something this morning when I was making notes for tonight's show, and I just am really glad somebody made this movie. I mean, everything you hear about the Prohibition era in this country is about either the pinstripe suit gangsters or Elliot Ness type cops. And you never really hear anything about the people that actually provided all the gangsters with the alcohol. And it's an interesting story because they're not really – I mean, it's against the law, yes, but, you know, what if they outlawed radio shows tomorrow? What are we going to do? You know, that's what they did for years and years and years previously, and then the government cuts off their only source of income by making it illegal, and they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And,
right.
You know, the change was filled with corruption and all this kind of stuff. I just thought it was a great story that hasn't been told yet, and I'm glad somebody looked into it.
It is a great story. I had to sort of reconcile myself with the idea that this movie was not going to have the same aspirations as the book does. I had to sort of, you know, just kind of, you know, just say, okay, I can't go in here thinking that this is going to be the wettest county in the world, because it's not.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is clear mandate is to be a 1930s gangster movie, and that's really all it sets out to be. I don't think it has any of the ambition of the book. It doesn't. It leaves out a whole half of the film of the book, and I think there's a certain entrepreneurial spirit and sense of American ingenuity that's at the heart of the novel that I don't think is really there in this one, in the movie. So once I was able to get around that and just accept it for what it is, this is a pretty damn cool movie.
Yeah.
That's really just about all it is. It's a really cool gangster movie with a lot of great actors and a lot of violence and you know, tough dudes talking tough, which I think is always cool. My only real complaint with it was Guy Pearce, who I think is distracting as Charlie Rakes. I did not like his character at all.
I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the things I have a hard time separating how the movie's supposed to make me feel and how the performance actually is. And I was wondering if that was just me, because you know, Charlie Rakes is a very effeminate, dressed down type Chicago special deputy who comes down basically looking down on all the hillbillies or hicks, as he says. And you know, he looks funny to them; they look funny, but he's got this annoying grit voice that you can hear in the trailer. Just second ago, and every time he's there, like, even his mannerisms are extremely annoying, but I couldn't decide if it was supposed to be that way or if it was over the top annoying.
Yeah, I mean, that's not the way Charlie Rakes is depicted in the book, but I don't know, so I don't know where that impression came from. That's the thing for me. I don't know if they just felt like the character didn't have enough of a voice that they needed to do something different with it, but I didn't think it was necessary. I feel like Guy Pearce has enough talent to be able to get that, make that role more on its own, rather than trying to ham it up the way he does here. I mean, he's sort of this, like you said, effeminate sexual deviant, but he's also extremely violent and cold at the same time. But it was just, compared to the grounded performances everybody else gave, I was just like, okay, yeah. I mean, it just didn't fit.
Yeah, I mean, especially seeing the last thing Guy Pearce, I really like Guy Pearce. I've never understood why he's not bigger, but the last movie I saw him, like or hate the movie, Lockout was a good character role for him. That he was a very likable character. He played it wonderfully.
Best part of a fairly average movie.
Yeah, but he was a really, really good best part. Like it's something you remember. Like I've never laughed that hard at the one liners of an action hero in. Like, seriously laughed, not like, oh my God, that stupid laugh, in quite a long time. But, you know, outside of that, I think the rest of the cast was awesome. Jessica Chastain, I don't know. I mean, I know where they were going with some of the stuff, but, you know, they were dropping hints about her previous life in Chicago and all this kind of stuff. It never came to any fruit. I don't know that it was necessary to the story. You know, in the book, maybe there's room for it. I don't know that all that was necessary to the story. But Tom Hardy as Forrest. You know, I read something this afternoon that his character was actually, and if you see the pictures at the end of the movie, you'll see that Forrest was actually a lot thinner than Tom Hardy. He wasn't muscle bound, but because he just played Bane, you know, he was bigger in the movie.
Right.
And I think that worked a lot. I mean, that gave him a real mountain man, corn fed, salt of the earth type, no nonsense guy look.
Yeah, he's
and,
very different than the way Forrest is depicted in the novel, where he's sickly and thin. But he's tough. I mean, he's as tough as he's you know, depicted in the movie and all that stuff. But he's not the physical presence that he is, you know, in the film. Not at all.
Yeah. I think it was almost important. Not only just to show what he was doing as far as the film. I mean, but also to show that Guy Pearce was really. I mean, when you have a guy like Tom Hardy staring you down, and you're about as skinny as Guy Pearce, you're probably going to look away or something, but he's standing right up to him with no fear because he's going down there assuming he has the power of the government behind him and everything. And I think in that sense it helped too. But outside of that, you know, Shia LaBeouf, I agree with you completely. He was a lot better than I expected him to be, especially in the first 10 minutes of the movie. You know, I started to hear that Sam Witwicky whining type voice, but it went away and he did a great job with it. I still don't like him, but he was good in this movie. I mean, come on.
I don't know. I like him as well. I like pretty much everybody here. Jessica Chastain as Maggie. I think her character's a little bit more mysterious in the novel. I feel bad that I keep comparing it to the novel, but I love that book so much that it's hard for me not to.
I just bought it this morning, as a matter of fact, so I hope it's good. I'm getting ready to start reading it.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's excellent. And Mia Wasikowska is good as well. I thought everybody was strong. But like I said, it's just don't go in there expecting it to be what the novel was. Don't go in there expecting it to be the... Well, I guess we'll talk about this more when it gets to the box office segment, but they've had a hard time trying to find a way to market this film.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, it looks like a prestige piece with all these actors in it. It's coming out around the same time as most prestige movies are, but it's not that. It's just a straightforward gangster film. I don't look at it any differently than I look at something as The Untouchables.
Mm-hmm.
So, or Public Enemies. I look at them all the same way. This one is better than Public Enemies by far, and nearly on par with The Untouchables for me. So, I mean, I give this a 3.5 out of 5. I do think it's a very good film. Like I said, just go in there with a certain expectations for it.
Yeah, it gets a 4 out of 5 for me. I think it was everything that I wanted it to be, and I don't know if that score is elevated because I still had a bad taste in my mouth from Public Enemies, which was a fine movie, but when they marketed it the way they did, you expect an action movie. If you don't get what you're expecting, it's always going to leave a bad taste in your mouth. And this movie gave you, if you don't know anything about the book and you just watch the trailers on TV and you go into the theater, you're going to get what you wanted. You're going to get all the violence, all the action, all the badassery that you could handle, and still a good story to tie it all together. So I really liked it. It gave me everything I wanted. I give it a 4 out of 5.
All right. Let's jump into the box office. We still got about 40 minutes left in the show, so we're doing okay.
Well, first we got to talk about Possession.
There's people that need to know.
Oh, all right. Never mind.
I forgot about The Possession weekend. Because I didn't even see it. So go ahead and talk about The Possession for us.
No, I was just joking. That's why I just wanted a reason to play that clip.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't get a chance to see it.
Okay, I didn't see it either then. It opened cold here in D.C., so I wasn't about to stay up till 3 in the morning to see it and then write a review over this weekend. So I was like, screw that. But it did scare up enough money to take the top spot at the box office, so somebody went to see it. $17.7 million is the opening for The Possession. Still a pretty weak opening for a pretty weak crop of movies overall. That's not bad for this film, though. I mean, it only had about a $14 million production budget. No big stars. The biggest is Jeffrey Dean Morgan. But it did have Sam Raimi as a producer, which they did hype up quite a bit. But $17.7 million for that is not that bad.
You know what I'm surprised about is that they did hype up Sam Raimi, but they didn't ever make, at least from what I saw, they weren't making the connection to Drag Me to Hell as much as they should have been. I think that's a movie that surprised a lot of people by how good it was. And this one deals with the same type of demons. You know, Sam Raimi's on it. They should have really connected it a little bit better there.
Yeah, maybe they should have. All right, number two is the movie we just finished talking about, which is Lawless. And this goes back to what I was saying a minute ago about the Weinsteins not really knowing how to market it. $9.67 million. First of all, when $9 million is the number two movie, you know it's been a terrible week.
Yeah.
but that is the second place film, $9.67 million for Lawless. Not that great of a start for a film with a lot of A-list talent in it. And, you know, as much as I love Tom Hardy, the guy can't seem to find a movie to call his own that has any kind of success. I mean, that goes for Warrior, which without any explanation, just bombed.
Yeah.
That goes for This Means War, which has two other A-list stars in it along with him. I don't know what it is, but unless he's in, you know, a movie that's going to rise and fall without him anyway, he can't seem to score a hit. It's really weird.
It's really going to bug me. No, it's not going to bug me. It's going to piss me off if he goes the way of Taylor Kitschen, Sam Worthington, and any other people that had, like, mega... Because he's actually good. I mean, he's actually really a great actor. Anybody that hasn't seen Bronson,
he's very good.
That out. Because it shows his range to everything. And he's a great actor. I really like him, and I'll be pissed if he doesn't start to get more stuff. I'm actually really, really surprised this didn't do that well.
Well, we'll have to see what happens with this Jack Ryan franchise that Paramount is rebooting, because with Chris Pine as Jack Ryan, they're planning that spinoff of it called Without Remorse, which they want to have Tom Hardy play the lead character in that. That could be the role that does it for him, but we're still at least a few years away from that. All right, number three is The Expendables 2, which is now up to $66 million total. It's inching its way up there. It's clearly not going to do what the first film did, not at all, which kind of has me worried about the prospects of The Expendables 3. But
it doesn't worry me because I don't even know if I want to see an Expendables 3, and that's coming from me. Because I think I got what I want out of this one, and I don't want to risk ending on a bad note.
Right. I want to see it just because they've already got Nicolas Cage set for it. So that's all I want to see. I want to see it for that. I want to see how he interacts with all those guys.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
Yes, it would. Then again, The Expendables, it did most of its money overseas. I hope that this one does as well. Number four is The Bourne Legacy at $96.2 million total now. It is pretty much doing the same thing as The Bourne Identity did about a decade ago, which that should make Universal very happy because it was the next two movies that really started to make serious money. So hopefully that happens here as well. Number five is Paranorman, $38 million total. Number six, The Odd Life of Timothy Green, which is now up to $35.9. Number seven is The Dark Knight Rises at $431 million domestic. It's closing in on $1 billion, I think, worldwide now. Number eight is The Campaign, up to $73 million. And another quote-unquote political movie right after it, to 2016, Obama's America, the documentary, which is doing extremely well these last couple weeks. $18.2 million. Got into a nice argument with somebody on our Facebook page about that, which is fun. And number 10 is Hope Springs with Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. Just past the $50 million mark now at $52 million, so it's doing pretty well. The biggest thing I thought was hilarious was the debut of Oogie Loves in the Big Balloon Adventure. I don't know if you had seen the commercials for this
movie. No, I saw like 3 seconds of one, and it looked like another kids' TV show acid trip that I didn't want to see.
So horrible. Not only does it look horrible, it looks scary. I mean, you got these big, bright costumes and kids singing along, and it just looks kind of like a cult. It just looks really weird. But the movie opened at over 2,000 theaters, which surprised me in and of itself that it had that wide of an opening. But it only made $450,000, which is a $207 per site average, which meant that every parent in the country kept their kids away from this piece of crap.
Well, let's put it this way. Google image search Oogie Loves, and you'll see why. I don't understand how everybody's bitching about violence in cartoons in the 80s. I would much rather have my kids see people shooting red lasers and jumping out of an exploding plane too late than I would see whatever the hell. This is the seventh circle of hell I'm looking at here.
Yeah, it looks really, really scary. And I think parents looked at that thing. And if you looked at the trailer, at the TV spots, I mean, it's a totally interactive movie. Like, it wants your kids to be singing in the theater and moving along to the music. That's what it wants.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think any parent wants to go sit through that? Any parent?
Not at the end of the summer. And releasing this then is the stupidest thing possible. You know, every movie theater does those matinee deals where you can bring 37 kids for $10. I mean, this movie would have done a lot better if they released it in June.
This would have done a lot better if they had released it only at, like, schools or something, like for preschool kids. But there's not a parent would be more than happy to take their kid to some lousy movie, as long as their kid is just sitting there and quiet and watching it. Mm-hmm. But that's not the point of this movie.
It's to rile them up.
Right. It's to get them up and singing and dancing, and it wants the parents to get in there, too. No parent's going to sign up for an hour and a half of that. Mm-hmm. No way. So the movie gets what it deserves. The worst 3-day opening, I think, in history, or it's really it's up there. So enjoy.
Wow. On $448,000 isn't bad for a movie that opens on 7 screens. 2,106, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Just real quick before we close out on box office, Expendables 2 has a worldwide gross of $132 million. It is doing better foreign, but only by $400.
Yeah, okay. But I think it'll probably last longer out there, too, so we'll see.
Oh, yeah, yeah. jumping into DVDs, we have The 5-Year Engagement hits Blu-ray.
It was better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot most of it by now already, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was looking at it, and I was like, ooh, 5-Year Engagement. I like everybody in it. And then I was looking at it, and I was like, I didn't like it that much. So.
Well, maybe they're hoping to trick a lot of people into forgetting that and buying it. Jason Statham rescues another young Asian girl in Safe.
I already pre-ordered it. I love that movie.
I mean, I know I said that and it sounded like I was making fun of it, but I was just stating a fact. I still love anything he does.
It's very good. It's one of his best. He's actually had a couple of good ones in a row because The Mechanic was really good and Safe is really good. Blitz is horrible. I don't know if
that
you
was
had
a straight to DVD one, wasn't it?
I think it had an extremely limited release, but it's mostly straight to DVD. It's really crappy. It's on cable right now too, so you don't even have to worry about.
I've tried to watch it three times on Netflix. And I can never get through.
It's so boring. So boring.
Piranha 3DD hits Blu-ray this Tuesday. Make sure to check out our page here at Blog Talk Radio. We will be airing an interview with the director of Piranha 3DD that you guys won't want to miss on release date. So check that out.
John Guliger. Who many will remember from Project Greenlight and his Feast trilogy.
Yes, and we did talk about Project Greenlight for a little while.
Really?
So you guys can hear about that. Yeah, he talked a lot about the antics on screen and you know why he was pissed off and how everybody's doing now.
He looked bad on that show.
Yeah.
He did not come off well.
But we talked it out. I had him sit on the couch. We talked it out, and everything's good now. A lot of new releases to Blu-ray only. Stuff that's been out for a while, but now on Blu-ray. Hand That Rocks the Cradle, the movie that got me to notice Rebecca De Mornay first time, super hot.
Titanic.
Yes.
Four disc combo, Blu-ray, 3D, Blu-ray, whatever. Titanic. So yeah, finally out on Blu-ray. Go ahead and get it. Anything you want to.
Yeah, go ahead and do that, folks. And make sure you do it for punchdrunkcritics.com. Click on Shop Punch from Critics in the upper right-hand corner. Reanimator, a cult horror movie on Blu-ray. The Office, Season 8. I just started watching The Office again because they updated Netflix's queue, and it's such a good show. And Return of the Killer Tomatoes, I know everybody's waiting for that. That's coming out. And that's about it. I also do have and Netflix finally updated their stuff. The newest movies on Instant right now that are worth a watch are Jiro Dreams of Sushi, one Travis loved that we talked about a while back. The original Mission Impossible, one of Mark Wahlberg's best movies, I think, Shooter. The J.J. Abrams movie Super 8, Traffic, Battle Royale, Glengarry Glenn Ross, and Beverly Hills Cop is also on there too. So there's quite a few choices on Netflix Instant right now, so check those out as well.
Nice.
Duff.
All right.
That is all she wrote.
All right, from there, let's jump into a little bit of news. Why don't we do that? I actually don't have very much news this week. It's been a week mostly of photos and clips. There hasn't been a lot of big breaking news or anything like that, which is, I don't care. It's fine with me. But not a lot of news to talk about this week.
A lot of good new trailers, though.
A lot of good new trailers. New trailer for On the Road came out this weekend. This Must Be the Place with Sean Penn, where he's in drag, which is scary. Two trailers for Seven Psychopaths, which I cannot wait for that movie. Seven Psychopaths is the follow-up from Martin McDonagh, who gave us In Bruges a couple years ago. And it has an incredible cast. Colin Farrell's back. Christopher Walken, Sam Rockwell, Abby Cornish, Olga Kurylenko. Incredible group. Woody Harrelson. And it looks just as foul-mouthed and politically incorrect as the other one did. In Bruges,
by the way, severely underrated flick. A lot of people haven't seen it. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's a great movie.
Yep. We got a trailer for The Company You Keep, which is another film I cannot wait for. Robert Redford, Britt Marling, Shia LaBeouf. Looks amazing. The Iceman with Michael Shannon as Robert Kuklinski, otherwise known as the Iceman Killer, the Mafia Hitman. Another trailer for The Master from Paul Thomas Anderson. Cannot wait for that, of course. And The To-Do List. I have to see this movie. This is Aubrey Plaza playing a girl who's on her way to college who's going to try out every sexual thing she didn't do in high school. It looks nasty. It looks great. I can't wait. I know. I'm into
souls.
Yeah. And the trailer just basically starts off with her listing all the jobs she's going to do.
Yeah, a preview of things to come, as it were.
Yep. And one other thing for me that I put in there, kind of a personal one, which is this ECW documentary that's coming out. It might be titled No One Is Safe. I haven't really decided on the final title yet. But this ECW documentary is coming out. Anybody who's a pro wrestling fan the way I am knows Extreme Championship Wrestling and how much of an impact it had on the business in the 80s, early 90s, and 2000s. There's a documentary coming out, and it looks fantastic. They have a Kickstarter program for it up right now, where you could donate a few bucks, basically become an investor in the film to get it completed. But I have
how much have you invested so far?
I invested $30. So
I mean, yeah, ECW is they're where like Terry Funk really started getting going, right?
Yep, Terry Funk made his big comeback in ECW. A lot of the guys got their big breaks there. Stone Cold Steve Austin, Rob Van Dam, a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. Rey Mysterio, Chris Benoit. But a lot of guys got their starts in ECW and have really taken off.
Yeah.
If you can spare a few bucks, if you're a wrestling fan, take a look. Go to their Kickstarter site and check it out. Just go to our site and look up ECW documentary. It's not hard to find.
Yeah, honestly, but, even if you're not a super fan, if you're just a casual fan of wrestling, like, you know, I watched in the late 90s, early 2000s pretty religiously, but if you ever watch wrestling and you like when it goes outside the ring or it's not just wrestling moves, you have ECW to thank for that. They're the ones who introduces everything like, you know, table chairs matches, ladder matches, barbed wire rope matches, all that stuff. Before then, everybody else was just doing regular wrestling. So
WWE's Attitude Era was basically taken exactly from ECW. They had the technical wrestling, the hardcore wrestling, and great storylines and characters that kind of pushed the envelope. WWE just flat out copied it from them, and I think Vince McMahon will even admit to that if you press them on it. But check it out. I think it's worth donating a couple bucks to, and the guys that are making it are good guys. So
indeed.
Do that. All right, news wise, here's the things I have lined up. I only took four this week. The Hobbit trilogy. We now know it's going to conclude on July 28th, 2014. The film was recently turned into a trilogy, basically over Comic-Con. It was around the time where we started hearing about Peter Jackson having some additional footage that he wanted to shoot. So it's officially a trilogy. It'll end in July of 2014. The second film has been retitled now. It will now be called The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. Because it doesn't really make sense to keep calling it There and Back Again if it's not the end of the trilogy.
I know that makes sense to the story, but that just sounds way too Star Wars subtitle for me.
It is a little Star Warsy. I don't disagree with you on that. It's a little Star Warsy. Smaug is of course the dragon that they're basically going to slay for the entire film. My biggest concern about The Hobbit, and I really haven't gotten excited for it yet, even though we're only a couple months away from seeing it, I'm still not excited. But my biggest thing with it is that The Hobbit in and of itself is really sort of a thin novel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's not, I mean, Tolkien left a lot of stuff out on purpose. And I know Jackson's basically going back and putting all that stuff back in. But even so, it's a thin novel that was made for children. And
yeah.
I had this problem figuring out how he's going to pad it out into three movies.
Well, I think what you just said there is going to be the main problem. I mean, the original Lord of the Rings trilogy was three books. You have three books, three movies. This
right.
just seems like there's, in my mind, unless I'm missing something, there's no reason to stretch this into three movies other than for financial reasons, to make more money, to make people buy three tickets instead of one. And with a book as frankly small as The Hobbit, to make it into three movies, it's going to be padded. There's going to be a lot of crap that you don't want to watch, and it's going to suffer because of it.
Mm. I'll say this. I don't think Jackson's motivations are financial and wanting to do a third film. I think the studios are certainly, but not for him. I think he's as true a fan of Tolkien stuff as anybody, and I think he legitimately because they had the rights to all this extra stuff that Tolkien had done,
mm.
and he wanted to shoot it. And you know, I think those are his motivations purely, but still. Was it necessary to expand it into a third film? Probably not. I don't think so.
No.
All right, so that's that. What else do I have here? Oh, yeah, this one. These next two things involve the Justice League franchise that DC is trying to get off the ground here. The first thing was merely both of these are actually rumors, but the first rumor was that there'll be a brand new Batman solo franchise that would start after his character is debuted in Justice League. To me, that makes sense. I think if you're going to try to get as far away from Christopher Nolan's work as possible, one way to do that is to introduce Batman in a ensemble like Justice League.
Right.
And, you know, so that makes sense. I guess what surprises me most about that, if this were to be true, is that they would consider doing another Batman franchise within the next 4 or 5 years, potentially. I figured they would wait a lot longer than that.
2 years ago, I would completely agree with you, but I think the Spider-Man reboot inside of 3 years really kind of opened the door to let them keep doing stuff like that. I hope they don't take the success of The Dark Knight, and I know they will, but and factor it into making him the major character. Because in my mind, in my impression of the Justice League, Batman should be almost a guest starring role, like just sweeping in, giving his 2 cents. Because he doesn't want to be part of the team. He is part of the team, but he'd never trust anybody. He's not there all the time. He's not, you know, coming to the luncheons. He should just be in and out.
Right. I agree with that. If I were reading the comic, but this is the movies. They're not going to present the paranoid version of Batman. You know what I mean?
Some of the best stories, though, man.
Oh no, they make for great stories, and they make for stories that make sense too. But it's kind of like Black Panther and the Avengers. He's the paranoid guy there. He's kind of the same way. But they're not going to present that version of Batman in the movies because that won't jive. You know, people don't want to see that. They can have internal conflict and not have him be the guy who wants to who has everybody's weaknesses. You know,
they don't
want to see that Batman.
You're right. They don't have to. In order for me to be happy, and I know that's the studio's number one concern. they don't have to go into depth about, you know, him keeping a piece of kryptonite here and this. But I would like to see at least a throwback to the fact that he keeps files on anybody. Because I mean that's it sounds paranoid at first, but then as soon as he kind of matter of factly explains, oh, I keep files on everybody because who knows what might happen. You know, if somebody's mind controlled or whatever. You know, I think that shows how smart he is, not how paranoid he is. And I'd like to see at least a throwback to it.
Right. Okay. So that's one rumor that's out there, and it's a fairly weak rumor at this point. So who knows if it's true or not? It might not be. All right. The next thing has to deal with the director of Justice League. Now we've already heard Ben Affleck be very explicit, very clear that he's not interested in being a director of the Justice League movie. We've seen the Wachowskis' name thrown out there over the last couple weeks. But there was also a report that added a few other names to the list, and two of them are really, really terrible. First of all, Ruben Fleischer, who directed Zombieland and also did Gangster Squad. That's a good choice, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I like Ruben Fleischer, and since the writer of the Justice League movie is Will Beale, who wrote Gangster Squad, it kind of makes sense to keep the team together. So, I mean, I like that idea a little bit.
Right.
But the other two names, on the other hand, not so much. McG is one guy who gave us This Means War. He also gave us the not so great Terminator Salvation,
mm-hmm.
and in both Charlie's Angels movies.
He did give us Supernatural though.
Great.
I'm just saying.
And
just saying.
And the other name on the list is Brett. I Killed the X-Men Ratner. So,
oh, Jesus Christ. Are you serious?
Yes. And this is all rumor. This is all rumor. So who knows if it's true. Reportedly, there are a couple more names on the list as well that we don't know yet. But those choices, those three choices, two out of them scared the shit out of me.
Dude, Brett Rat, is he, I mean, as self-involved as Hollywood is, stereotypically at least, I would find it hard to believe that they don't read any of the you know, fanboy blogs and stuff like that. And even if they didn't, I'm pretty sure it's common knowledge that nobody likes what Brett Ratner does.
They read them and don't care. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we go out there and say Brett Ratner fucking sucks dick and he shouldn't ever touch a comic book movie again. It doesn't matter if we say that. Because the fact is, his movies all make money.
Here's the sad part. So did The Dark Knight, and they made it for fans. Not for fans, but they made something the fans like. There are people out there that don't suck, that can make the movie, that could make money. But
they probably won't all be as easy to get as Brett Ratner.
True. True.
Unfortunately. Or be as... Or, you know, the thing with Christopher Nolan is, as much as we love him, we love his movies and all that stuff,
uh-huh.
not everybody not every studio wants to have that guy who basically runs the show themselves, which is what Christopher Nolan earned with the Dark Knight movies. I guarantee you, when he made Batman Begins, he didn't have the leeway he had with the next two movies. A guy like Brett Ratner would come in there and probably wouldn't give a shit what any of us thought and would just do whatever the studio wants him to do. And they get, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, I hear you completely, but
extremely easy to work with, you know. You know, he wouldn't come in there with too many ideas. He would give the studio. He's a gun for hire. He would come out there and do whatever they ask him to do and present them the movie that they think they want.
I refuse to give him the power of a gun. He's a Nerf gun for hire. We'll put it that way.
So I mean, guys like Brett Ratner and McGee, these guys will always get work for various reasons. You know, whether we think they're good or not. So
yeah, it's just unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. I think he's terrible, and I don't think McGee's that whole lot better. I will cop to liking the Charlie's Angels movies, though, mainly because it's three hot chicks kicking ass, which, you know, I'm a sucker for.
Yeah, he doesn't. But my problem with McGee is not really his filmmaking; it's his name. What kind of pretentious douchebag calls himself McGee?
It's horrible.
But
yeah. And the last thing for me, ABC has greenlit, they've ordered up a pilot of Joss Whedon's S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series. We had been talking about this for a couple of months when we knew that he was making, that Marvel was planning a Avengers TV series. And it turns out it's going to be a series based on S.H.I.E.L.D., the espionage division that Nick Fury runs. Basically, that's really pretty much all we know about it, except it'll deal with the men and women who run that organization. We don't know if Nick Fury will even be in it. Probably not. There'll probably be more of the supporting characters that we've seen. But Whedon will be writing and possibly directing the pilot. But it'll be his brother Jed Whedon and Marissa Tanker-Rowan who will be the actual showrunners. And the series is not guaranteed to fit into the Marvel Cinematic Universe either. He says it'll be autonomous from the Avengers sequel that he's working on now. So we don't know what kind of tie-ins it's going to have or if it even will. If we'll see any characters from the movies in it, probably not, because they all have specific appearance clauses in their contract. And I doubt that Marvel will be like, yeah, let's waste one of those appearances on their contract on the TV series.
Right.
So I doubt that'll happen. But what I do think has potential to happen is to have them introduce superheroes on the show. I do think is a possibility, and I think that makes this series very cool if it gets finally greenlit and made a go for an upcoming season. I think that is what makes this show potentially really important.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, even honestly, if the show fails miserably, it would be almost good business sense to keep it on the air, just as a way to introduce it. If it's different actors and different stories, or whatever, just so people know the names, they can associate something with them, and it's not something brand new to them. He was on a TV show. It's a great way to introduce those background players, because there's so many superheroes. I feel bad leaving all of them out.
Right. No, there's a ton of them, and there's a lot of people in S.H.I.E.L.D. that are important as well in the Marvel Universe. So I'm curious to see where this goes. I guess for Joss Whedon, it'll be nice to have a show that he knows is going to get some actual, like, press and marketing and all that stuff.
Right.
None of his other shows ever do. Unless it's Buffy or
We give Angel. McGee $100 million projects, and this guy has to work hard for everything he gets.
Right. And all his shows are always cult favorites that nobody watches. This is one show that it would have to really, really shit the bed for people not to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have to be really awful for whatever reason for this show to not get watched. So,
I really want to see how it does, just because we've been promised a lot, not a lot, but a few big name TV adaptations, like the Star Wars thing that still hasn't happened. And, you know, I just really want to see how one of these translates to a live action superhero TV show, just because the budget can't be anywhere near the same. I'm really interested to see how that works.
Well, considering it's ABC, who is, you know, part of Marvel and part of Disney, they should have some pretty good synergy going on there. And I imagine that it'll probably get a pretty decent-sized budget, too. So, I mean, we'll see. They still got to do the pilot. They still has to be, you know, still has to be given the big thumbs up. But I'm excited to see where this goes.
Oh, no doubt, yeah.
This is a huge thing. This is one of those things that's kind of a game changer. It's like, if this succeeds and they find a way to make this work in the context of the movie franchise, it could be incredible. I mean, it could be Marvel dominating on the big and small screen. I mean, you have to remember, they also have this Hulk TV series that they're working on that has Guillermo del Toro attached to it in some way. If those things work as well, I mean, Marvel is just taking over, man.
I mean, even the ripple effect on those things, just showing that something like that can do well. I mean, you open up the door for a lot of name. I mean, TV is not the stigma it used to be, but a lot of people still won't go to TV if they exclusively do film. But if you have Del Toro coming down, if you have this stuff doing well, you'll get to see a lot of higher quality TV shows, I think.
Yeah. And it's just interesting when you compare it to what, to the kind of the struggles that DC is having getting their Justice League thing off the ground. It's just, it's night and day between the two companies right now. It just really is. So.
Yeah. They had to be so bitter. They thought they had the world by a string after Dark Knight came out.
Well, they did for a long time.
Yeah.
They did for a long time, but that's over with now. And it's their fault for not planning ahead better. I mean, we'll have to wait and see how Man of Steel does next year. I had high hopes after. I had high hopes before Superman Returns, and that didn't work out. So I don't want to get too amped up for Man of Steel, because it could shit the bed too.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
That's kind of why the Brett Ratner thing pisses me off so much. If the Marvel series wasn't there, you could easily say, you know, you want to make the most money. But they know now that you'll make more money if you make something good. I'm not going to get back into it. I'll just get pissed. What do you think about the RoboCop news? Michael Keaton taking the Dick Jones role. Actually, his name will be something else, not Dick Jones. Let me see here.
Yeah, it's something else.
Yeah, it's Raymond Sellers. But he's the villain, so I'm assuming he's the executive villain, so I'm assuming it's the Dick Jones role.
He's the CEO of Omnicorp. I like it. It's a lateral move, in my opinion. I like Hugh Laurie a lot. I like Michael Keaton just as much. And I like the fact that Michael Keaton's been making a pretty, I don't want to call it a comeback, because he never really left. But he's getting more prominent roles again, which I think is great. Cause I think
he's
definitely. Good stuff.
I don't think he ever fell off. I just think people forgot about him, because he never really had a string of bad movies. But it was something just in conjunction with it, something that we might have upcoming. There's a new poster out for Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D, which is not just a 3D version of the Jessica Biel remake, unfortunately, because there are parts of that movie I'd love to see in 3D.
Say the title right. It's just Texas Massacre now.
Oh, no, that's right.
It's Texas Massacre 3D. That's all it is.
Well, now the windows just come out of my sails. But I got a chance to meet
Bill Mosley. I wanted to get your opinion on them shortening the title like that. I mean,
it's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. If you think of that movie, you think two things: the word Leatherface and a chainsaw.
Right.
That's like making Titanic 2 without a boat. Actually, they already did that. Speed 2, it was on a boat. Instead of bus. That's stupid. You don't... whatever. But I got a chance to talk to Bill Mosley this weekend, who's a really big name in the horror world. He was in stuff like the Army of Darkness. He was in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. All of the Rob Zombie films, pretty much. This guy is really disturbing in real life. He's a very Ted Bundy-ish kind of guy. He plays all these psychotic, like, people in these horror movies, but he is the most normal, like, looks like he'd be a Baptist minister type person. But I had a chance to talk to him for a couple minutes, and he's going to be working something out, so hopefully we can get him in and talk to him for a little bit about Texas Chainsaw Massacre before that comes out. So,
Texas Chainsaw 3D.
That
poster is really disturbing, too.
It is. I was about to say, I do like the poster, because I think a lot of people, casual fans, just remember Leatherface having one mask. But he actually cut the mask. I mean, in the remake, you saw that he was wearing... Dude Man's mask, Jessica Biel's boyfriend, and it's shelves of all the different faces. It's really gross, really disturbing, and you should look at it.
Yeah, it's gross. Mm-hmm. It actually sent a chill up my spine when I first looked at it. I was like, ooh.
Yeah. you know a poster's disturbing when you can smell how stinky it is in that room.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And that's pretty much all I had, honestly.
Same here.
Wondering with myself.
We're 5 minutes early. All right, next week's show. Next week is probably the weakest weekend of movies ever. Next week, brings us The Cold Light of Day, which is the movie with Bruce Willis and your future Superman, Henry Cavill. It's opening cold, so we don't know if we're even going to see it in time to do the show. We also have an interview with Jamie Bradshaw, who's the director of Branded, which is the upcoming sci-fi film that a lot of people are talking about right now. Kind of looks like a John Carpenter, They Live sort of thing, which I think is awesome. So that we have an interview with him next week. Hopefully we'll get a chance to see the movie as well, because that one's another one that's opening cold next week too. So and also the other film that's coming out next week is The Words with Bradley Cooper and Zoe Saldana. Another one I saw at Sundance. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that next week as well. In other words, that means you need to go see it, John. And that's really it. So there's not a lot coming out next week, so we may find something else to do in the meantime.
We haven't done a list in a while. Perhaps we'll do a list for you guys. We are really getting into nap time of the movie release schedule. Before we started getting into award season and stuff like that, summer is officially over after this weekend, movie-wise.
Look, it's September 21st, that weekend.
Yeah.
There are 7 movies coming out that week alone, and they're all big movies.
But most of them are limited. Like, I'm for the next... And until the 21st, the next, 3 weeks, there's only 2 large opening movies. The Words next weekend and Resident Evil Retribution on the 14th. Everything else is open.
Another one that's opening cold, I might add, that we won't get to see ahead of time. So,
when did those movies turn into The Matrix?
I don't know. Those movies are weird to me. Yeah. September 21st, man. Listen to this list of movies that are coming out September 21st. There's so many that I'm going to be parsing them out to you and Rocky and Julie.
You got it.
House at the End of the Street with Jennifer Lawrence comes out that week. End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena. Freaking excellent movie, I might add. Liberal Arts with Elizabeth Olsen and Josh Radnor. Dread 3D. Trouble with the Curve with Clint Eastwood. The Master with Paul Thomas Anderson, of course. And 10 Years, the Channing Tatum movie. So September 21st is just insane, and the week after that is just as big. And don't even get me started on October. It's just sick. We are in the awards season, folks. It's not going to slow down at all.
No, I think we will enjoy this rest of not having to talk about and review new movies for the next 2 weeks, because once it starts. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about this business is that summertime is the busiest time. No.
Biggest
time where we'll have like 10 or 12 movies a week that Travis reviews.
Yeah, I know. And summertime is the time for big movies, but nothing ever comes out opposite them.
Right.
So this is the time where everybody's on equal footing and they all just come out at the same time. So it's gonna be busy.
So make sure to check us out next week, because we'll bring you some original stuff. We'll get a list together or something fun. And make sure to check out the website every day, punchdrunkcritics.com. You can get all your DVD, Blu-ray home needs. You can buy a DVD player from Blu-ray player from us. Excuse me. At shop at punchdrunkcritics.com, which is powered by Amazon. Anything else you want to add, Travis?
That's it. Let's get out of here.
All right, we are out. Good night, folks. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next week.
Later.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so, that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.